long curve and journey that my family has gone on that on. And I found that the more I learned, the more I educated myself, the more I found that I was in a better place to be able to love and support moving forward, to answer the questions, to look for resources. And it kind of brought our family back together.
You mentioned the number 225,000 users in the province. I mean, the nature of the toxic drug supply is that any one of those people could find themselves in an overdose situation. It's not about people only people who've maybe experiencing long-term addiction or very, I don't know what the right term is for, but are really in the clutches of addiction, but really anyone who's a user could be vulnerable.
Any single person in this country at this moment who uses a substance purchased from the illicit market is at risk of death. There's no getting away from that. It is so adulterated, and that people have no clue what they're buying. They have no clue what dosage that they need to use. They have no idea of if this could be their first or last time using a substance.
That's pretty stark.
It is. It's like a game of Russian roulette. You know, my son, I mean, he had he was in addiction. He identified with an opioid use disorder. He was under care of primary physicians. At the same time, he also had a very high tolerance to certain opioids through just prolonged use, and it took him unawares. He didn't know. I mean, his toxicology report when it came back had high concentrations of a benzodiazepine, as well as fluorofentanyl and fentanyl. And he had probably no idea. He was just buying what he normally would buy. And it was that just that one last time.
That's really hard. We're coming up to a provincial election in the fall. I mean, in Mom Stop the Harm's recent press release, you call out all the parties for their failures in addressing the issues. So what policies and changes are you looking for from our political leaders as we head into a political campaign?
Policy-wise, you know, we work closely with a lot of government organizations. We sit on a lot of committees. And one thing I found in the last year is those committees are getting smaller and smaller, and they're not including people with lived and living experience in the same way that they were originally. And I think with any crisis, you need to include the voices who are directly affected by the crisis on hand. And I think with policy change, like the one that we've called out numerous times, is to have a robust, regulated system of recovery or treatment and recovery, which we don't at the moment. Our recovery industry or our treatment centers are non-regulated. And that's a concern. That's a huge concern because without regulation, they're not being monitored, they're not being evaluated in a form. A way that collects the data that we need to do to make the decisions that we need to make. So there's no data informing the decisions. There's no evidence behind the treatment that's being provided. And I know as a parent whose son had been in and out of treatment, that the options available to me were. It was amazing. I went online, went on to Google, boom, all these paid ads came up. You start working your way through them, but there was no way for me to evaluate outcomes to know where my money was going, how successful have they been. And that was in 2014 and 15. And in 2024, 10 years later, we're still in that same situation.
So
There is no way to know where people are going, what the programmings are around. Are they unique? Are they individualized? And it's hard to measure success, but it would be nice to know how many people start and complete a program, how many people within 2 and 3 days have actually had a fatal incident once they've walked out of treatment. Like that's the type of data we need to have.
And that's often one of the most dangerous periods for addicts. Is it
It's one
not?
of the it's an extremely dangerous period for anybody, and it's on par with those who've been incarcerated. You know, that first 24 hours, that first 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months. You know, we start looking at that, and we increased more tip, you know, morbidity and mortality is associated with abstinence-based programming, whether it's through jail, whether it's through treatment centers. So, you know, being able to look at that data and see and make informed decisions, I think, is extremely important. That's one thing that Moms Stop the Harm really does support. We also support a regulated supply of substances for those who need them, not necessarily in, you know, in a medicalized model. It could, because when we look at the rates of addictions haven't changed. So we have 225 self-identified drug users in this province. That doesn't mean we have 225,000 people with addiction. That means we have people that just use substances. And so if we pathologize and medicalize everybody that uses a substance, it doesn't work. It doesn't, you know, it really doesn't correlate. So we need to have options available for everyone. So if you identify with an OUD, you want to go, you know, you need medical help, you need that medicalized model to move forward. But what about those, you know, the young couple are celebrating, just, you know, graduating from grad school, that want to use cocaine? They're at just as at much risk of dying. And so if we could look at regulating a certain amount of supply for those who are not in addiction, because 80% of those people who are dying in their own private residences, generally, a lot of them are not in addiction.
So is the indication then that levels of use are not necessarily connected to availability of supply? I'm talking about in the general sense, like.
Well, no, I mean, it levels of use. So I think anybody can walk out the door and get supply that they need. That's not an issue. It's getting a supply that won't kill them is something completely different. And so there's a lot of programs. They're not a lot, I shouldn't say that. There are more and more programs being made available to people in addiction, with addiction, with an, you know, an identified opioid use disorder, that can get alternatives. And those alternatives are more on the harm reduction side. So we're talking about methadone, Kadian, Suboxone, et cetera, to help them with the withdrawals and with their addiction. But those who don't have addiction, who don't have a dependency, there's nothing available to them. If, and they're still going to use drugs. And that's the thing, is people have been using drugs since antiquity, and they're going to continue to use drugs. So we need to figure out a way that people can use substances in a safe manner that's not going to kill them.
So what would you say to the party leaders if you had an opportunity to sit down with them about what needs to be done? That's
You know, that's a tough one. I think just some honesty would be great from party leaders. Truthfully, like, let's look at the evidence. Let's follow the research. Let's really dig into what is going on and how, and work in a nonpartisan way. And how do we address this? And not do it as political pandering. And don't take one group of people and further marginalize them based for political points. And I think that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, stirring up the pot to create fear, to create votes, it's just so wrong on every level. And the ethics are really concerning when they, you know, when it comes to that. You know, basically work on a nonpartisan solution on what does work, because it affects so many families and so many individuals, that if we look at how, the data behind that, you know, what is it? 1 in 10 families are affected by someone's substance use. And if we could stop demonizing it and reduce the stigma and show some positivity towards action, towards solutions, that would really go a long way. But they're not. So as it stands right now, what would we say to the, you know, the different politicians? Would be just kind of stop demonizing people. Let's come up with some solutions. Let's work together. Listen to the voices that need to be heard in this crisis. And yeah, stop building political careers on the backs of people that are the most vulnerable in society at times.
Are there jurisdictions we can look to in BC or elsewhere that are doing a better job of dealing with the crisis?
There's different jurisdictions around the world. I mean, Switzerland has done a much better job of dealing with the crisis. Portugal has put in, with their model that they have there, that has seemed to suffice with them. But the one thing that North America has that the rest of the world doesn't have is fentanyl and its analogs and the toxicity of the drug market. Place else in the world actually has, they still have heroin, they still have cocaine, they still have methamphetamines, but they are a lot safer than what we have here. And it's really hard to look at those models and relate them back to what we're going through. They don't have the it, I think that's just what it comes down to is that the actual when fentanyl was introduced, the toxicity increased. And the harder their enforcement to keep fentanyl out of our country has actually made it even more toxic as they're looking to different precursors that are going into the drug supply.
I feel like that's perhaps a bigger question than we have time for, but why is it a problem here if not elsewhere?
I think at the beginning it was our proximity to the Asian market. A lot of this was coming out of China, and it is highly, highly addictive in a way that it wasn't before. But what was coming in, and I think that's what took people by surprise, is one, the potency, and it doesn't last as long. Like fentanyl doesn't have the legs that say heroin did, et cetera. So you're using more on top of it. The dependency is increasing. And then so as they started to, more enforcement on keeping fentanyl out, and COVID was a prime example of that, is when we really shut our borders down. People had to, they started looking at alternatives. And so those alternatives were being found here within the province. And instead of importing a lot of what we were doing, they started, actually manufacturing a lot of the substances here with what they could get their hands on and what they could easily get brought in. So if you increase border patrols, or if you increase that kind of, you lock that stuff down, the iron laws of prohibition actually are telling you that you need to decrease the size of what you're trying to do. You need, there's just, it actually increases the toxicity the more you increase the enforcement.
Right. Which is sort of a catch 22.
It
How
is.
do you address it? Which I guess points to other solutions rather than enforcement, which gets us back to the issue of making the supply safer and providing treatment.
I think that's exact, for us in the organization, it's one is making the supply safer. And that's something, and ramping up the response to this. And, it's so highly politicalized. And even I look at what the NDP is doing right now, government, if they've backed off, they've decided we're going to go this route because that's what what community wants. That's what the general public is saying. We need more treatment. We need detox. We need this. We need that. Well, we do. We need a robust system of treatment and detox, but we also need to keep people alive until they can get to treatment and detox. We don't have enough beds in this province. We don't have enough space. We're still looking at 3 weeks, 6 weeks to get into detox for a lot of places. We have minimal detox centers. A lot of treatment centers won't take anybody in until they've gone through detox. And one thing we know about addiction and in this crisis is when somebody decides, I want help and I want it now, we have to be available. We have to be able to respond now. And we don't have that capability right here in the province to do that. And particularly when you start looking at remote and rural communities, we look outside of, the little urban centers. So whether it's Vancouver or Victoria, Kelowna, Prince George, even Prince George is, doesn't have the resources that they need. And it kind of just compounds the situation. So, I think, and I lost track of the question. I'm sorry.
I guess perhaps is, in addition to the sort of specific failures of approach, is part of the issue just an unwillingness to spend the money or provide the resources needed to attack the issue aggressively?
I do believe that they've put a fair amount of funding into this. I think that it, they start a program or a project, it gets out of the gate, they do it as a review, like everything, and then the outcomes might not be what they want, they shut it down. So instead of, unlike other things, instead of saying, okay, this is working, but it's not working exactly how we want it, so let's tweak it a little bit. They say, okay, this kind of works, so we'll just shut it down and try something new instead of kind of taking the models that you have and enhancing them and putting more resources into it. We just keep shifting in all these little pilot programs across the province. And those little pilot programs really only can, accommodate up to, say, 100 people. So if we have 225,000 and maybe out of that 100,000 are looking to actually eventually stop using substances to get into a treatment program, we don't have that. We don't have the facilities for people, nor do we have facilities that need, that work in a way that address people's unique issues. Like it's kind of that one size fits all in so many places. This is what we do and how we do it. Whether either you conform to how we do it or you're out. And so most people are like, we're out then because we can't, So, that's a big part of the problem. So, no, I don't think it's a lack of funding. I think it's a lack of continual funding and actually funding programs that work.
Right.
And that comes down to evaluation, right? We need to monitor, we need to evaluate, and we need to collect data. And that's, we're not doing it in a way that is beneficial.
So, as someone who's seen the crisis up close within your own family, what would you say to our listeners, to, the regular person who doesn't have that experience and knowledge you have? What do they need to know about this crisis that might help them see clear what it is and what we need to do?
This crisis gets a lot of attention and gets a lot of media, and I think people are tuning out to it, and which is really makes it more difficult to for any kind of progress or forward change. But if it happens in your family, or if it happens to someone close to you, because there's a good chance in your neighborhood and on your cul-de-sac that there's two or three houses that this has affected those families, is that just a little bit of compassion, some caring, really start to educate yourself and start to look at people that use substances. They're people. They're just individuals. They're like everybody else, every other family. Like my son, he played hockey, he played baseball, he went to high school. He, they just the normal, everyday, average teenage kid, and grew up in a time where OxyContin was quite popular. During that. But so I just think that you need to educate yourself, to open your mind to the fact that we have stigmatized substance use for so many years. We moralize it when it's not a moral issue. It's an issue, a medical issue when it comes to addiction, and that we need to just kind of look at it a little bit differently. When people need help, they need help. When people ask for help, we need to have help available for them. But like you said at the beginning, for me, it comes down to education. Like really look a little deeper, look a little past what your inherent biases are. Maybe also think a little bit about what your relationship is to substances and where you stand on that. Because we can look at substances as being alcohol, caffeine, tobacco, illicit drugs, prescription drugs. And also recognize that a lot of youth that get started in this need a safe place and somebody to talk to about. And that most youth try substances in the home the first time. And that's something we need to be prepared to discuss. So talk to your kids about, we talk to our kids about safe alcohol consumption. If you're going to go to a party, how do you drink? What should you do? That type of thing. Well, we need to talk to our kids about safe drug use at the same time, but do it in a way that you're not just condemning them if they even think about doing it, but in a way that they're getting kind of from the educated point of view, saying this, there are substances, you're going to come across them, kind of approach it that way. And I think that, for me, I keep coming back to education. Educate yourself. There's so many resources out there that do that. There's so many different organizations that are willing to help, like, you know, Moms Stop the Harm. We get new members. Our organization is growing by leaps and bounds, and we don't, in a way that is just heartbreaking. That we get probably anywhere between 5 to 7 new members a week from across the country. And it's really hard to justify what we see that's happening politically to what we know is happening within people's families.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, and I'm very sorry for your loss. Can you tell me how people can find out a bit more about Moms Stop the Harm?
Okay, you can just go online. It's momstoptheharm.com, and there's a lot of different links on there to resources. We do have support groups for families. We have a bereavement group that's Healing Hearts, and we also have support groups called Holding Hope, and they are operated both in person and virtually across the country. We also have sections with, you know, different areas of resources, you know, that you can utilize and educate yourself with. And you can always reach out to us at info@momstoptheharm.com or here in BC at bcmomstoptheharm.com. And there's always somebody on the other end of the line that's willing to talk to you, particularly if you're in crisis. There's always somebody that will get back to you.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Tracy Letts is the board vice chair of Moms Stop the Harm. Thank you for speaking to me today on such an important issue.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note. For years, scientists debated whether the first flying dinosaurs, the ancestors of modern birds, began by running and making little hops off the ground, or leapt off a tree branch to glide. It's called the ground-up versus trees-down debate for short. But there's a newer perspective on this mystery. Maybe the old debate misses the point. Maybe flying dinosaurs tried jumping from more than one place. Whether leaping off a branch or off the forest floor, it probably began with the same motion, a firm push off the surface. After all, that's how birds do it today. Recent findings suggest that many dinosaur species had feathers, and some also had limbs that could flap like wings. One analysis suggested that the ability to fly could have evolved not just once, but 3 separate times among dinosaurs. So instead of the old picture of one lone dinosaur with prototype wings deciding how to use them, imagine many feathered creatures jumping and gliding all over. That fertile time of experimentation eventually led to the ancestors of all our familiar birds. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Support for Bird Note is provided by Sarah Murner and Craig McKibben from Seattle, Washington, and generous listeners around the world.
We had food growing up, and we were used to being able to eat, but then all of a sudden, we needed that help. That's why the food bank is here. They're here to help you, and they're here to help you.
The food bank is for anyone who needs one. Visit the food bank near you to help and be helped.
something curious, something cultural, something unserious, sometimes serious, something mundane, something everyday, though not even really that. Tune into Typically Tuesdays, airing every Monday, you heard that right, Monday, from 3 to 4 p.m., your hour of quasi-cerebral talk and tunes.